And our first presenter is a good one, Tim Anderson. With 40 years in the broadcasting field, Tim joined Gates Air in 2007 and is the manager of radio product and market development in the Mason, Ohio headquarters. Tim has published numerous technical articles on the subject of digital radio broadcasting and radio transmitter systems. He holds SBE Professional Broadcast Engineer, Digital Radio Broadcast, and Broadcast Engineer Network Engineer certifications. He serves on the National SBE Board, and he's the director, and he's also on the board of the Digital Radio Mondial Steering Board. He's also a commercial pilot. He lives in Covington, Kentucky. We're always glad to have him at our clinic, Tim Anderson. Tim?
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. All right. Okay. We're going to talk. I hope this is exciting. I want to wake you all up. We're going to talk about something that's been near and dear to my heart for the last several years. I think it was this group that I spoke to maybe 5 years ago about this idea of doing liquid-cooled FM transmitters. Now, it's not a new idea. It's been around for a little while, but the technology hasn't exactly been there to make it work very well. Some remember a particular tube transmitter that was liquid-cooled, and everybody knows high voltage and water don't mix very well. So that was an interesting experiment. Probably didn't go very well, but solid state has given us the opportunity to move forward with liquid cooling. And so what I want to talk to you about a little bit today is the benefits that we see in this that I've seen for quite some time and been talking about. And it's finally a reality. We're doing liquid cooled FM transmitters now quite successfully. The main push has been a more green initiative, lowering operating costs. We were approached some years ago when we were originally talking about this idea for the World Trade Center, to do the new World Trade Center with a tie-in to the master liquid cooling system and develop an entire range of both television and FM transmitters that were liquid cooled, and that kind of got us started down the path. A few twists and turns along the way, and I didn't pick up my clicker. So let's get started and talk about this a little bit. Energy costs are rising. Total cost of ownership has become more important, and electricity power consumption are one of the main drivers in the costs of transmitters, but there's a lot more to that. But if we look at power costs, they may rise as much as 20% by 2030. So anything we can do to conserve make more efficient the transmission system, the better off we're going to be. The squeeze is on to reduce operating expenses, and that's your plant, your power consumption, the energy used, the people, maintenance. All of these things tie together in terms of total operating costs. Sending people out to fix transmitters is expensive. The technology and maintaining the spares, also very expensive. Floor space is expensive. So the move is on to reduce all of the operating costs around our transmission system. When we look at the total cost of transmitter system operation, it's not just the purchase price, and it's not just the electricity that it takes to run it. Financing, building space requirements, shipping the transmitter onto the site, and then there's all the operational costs. Again, the power, personnel, training, the routine maintenance that it takes, repair costs, time for repair when the system may be down. Upgrades, keeping things current, and warranty, and a lot of other pieces go into this. So what's really important is the total operating cost. It's the total cost to own and operate the transmitter over its lifetime. That includes all of the things I mentioned before. And AC power, of course, is a big component of that. But there's a lot of other factors that affect that efficiency and the AC power consumption. There's losses everywhere. There's losses in the power system itself, in the power transformers. Heat load into the room, big one, and that's what we're kind of talking about today in terms of the HVAC costs. The RF system losses, they're fairly significant. All that turns into heat. For example, at 100 megahertz, 500 feet of 3 1/8 line loses about 15% of its of the power going into it. And antenna systems that aren't optimized also contribute to that. We're constantly looking at Gates Air at ways to improve the total cost of ownership. We look all the time at higher efficiency RF devices, higher efficiency power supplies, optimizing cooling systems, broadband, and trying to future-proof these systems so as things change, repack, we can stay up with that without purchasing, you know, entire new transmitter systems. We also look to improve the uptime. The mean time between failures has gone significantly up over the last several years, and the mean time to repair the systems has gone significantly down over the last several years. We also increase the power density. Every time we introduce a new transmitter, one of our goals is to double the power density, twice the power in half the space. That's a big goal in our design efforts, and we want to make them easier to use, easier to repair, more user-friendly designs. So we have a program called Power Smart, and it kind of permeates everything that we do at Gates Air. Every new initiative we take on, we look at in terms of energy consumption, space, power density. We take that into our television transmission products as well as our radio transmission products. One of the things that came out of some of the early Power Smart initiatives was a new way of doing power supplies. Power supply technology has improved by leaps and bounds over the last several years. Very, very high conversion efficiencies are being seen today in these smart power supplies. All of our systems run at around 50 volts these days. The devices are 50 volt devices. And we've leveraged commodity power supplies. We were the first company to really recognize these power supplies and start to use them in all of our products. Now, this is the standard power supply. It was originally made by a company called Lineage. They were bought out by a really small company called General Electric, who saw the benefit of these power supplies in just about everything. They're used in telecom switching systems, in computer rooms. These are very high-tech power supplies, incredibly high mean time between failures, 900,000-hour MTBFs. They're made by the tens and hundreds of thousands, so they're a very commodity-driven device, and they're very versatile. We can use them in just about everything. So this power supply has really changed the face of transmitter design, and add on top of that, they're about 96% AC to DC conversion efficient. Which makes them perfect in terms of total cost of ownership. For example, just a few years ago, the power supplies that were designed into most systems, including transmitters, had a typical efficiency of about 84% prior to these power supplies and this technology. Now we're looking at 96% AC to DC conversion efficiency. Well, how does that affect the transmitter? It's pretty significant. At the bottom, you can see there that 51% efficiency was attributed to the earlier systems, whereas just with these power supplies, if you took the exact same transmitter and just updated the power supplies, you get a 13% difference in power consumption. We go to 63% efficiency just with the power supplies. And that's the technology that we're all using today. Everybody has kind of moved to this smart power supply to take advantage of the higher efficiency. Also, device technology has changed dramatically in just the last 5 or 6 years. Now, LDMOS devices, I think I stood up here a few years ago and talked about LDMOS devices as well. They were a real game changer. They changed the entire complexion of transmission systems, because before the LDMOS, tubes made a whole lot more sense in transmitter design, because you could get better efficiency and the cost was so much lower. But of course, we all know the issues around tubes. Tubes tend to have very high voltages, take specialized training. People have to really know what they're doing around the high power tube-based transmitters. This changed everything. Transmitters are changing now. The entire industry is pretty much going to solid state because it's now cost effective. The break point before the LDMOS was probably somewhere around 10 kilowatts that it made any sense at all, and above that it just didn't make sense. But now with LDMOS, we're building transmitters 80 kilowatts, 40, 60, 80 kilowatts that are just as competitive as the same transmitters in a tube design system. And the solid state devices continue to evolve. When we introduced the FACS just 5 years ago, we were using a device that could do 1.25 kilowatts peak power. The latest devices that we're using now in the exact same family are capable of 1,400 watts of peak power. It just keeps going up. The efficiency keeps going up. These are now 82 to 84% DC to RF efficient. Better thermal transfer means easier to cool them. The heat gets out of the system faster, and they're even more rugged. These devices have a 20,000-year mean time between failure MTBF. Higher gain, higher power, just a real game changer in the entire industry. And there's cooling the transmitter, which is what we're here to talk about today. There's really basically three ways to cool a transmitter. The open loop system, where you draw air in from the outside, run that cool air through the transmitter, and then exhaust the hot air back out of the building. The other way, and probably one of the most accepted ways, is the closed loop system, where we put a really big air conditioner in the room and cool that room while we're cooling the transmitter, so it recirculates its own cooled air. And then there's liquid cooling, where we have a liquid cool system that pumps coolant through the transmitter, through the heat-producing devices, and takes it outside to a heat exchanger, not unlike your outside air conditioning heat exchanger. These all have advantages and disadvantages, although there aren't too many disadvantages with liquid cooling. I'm not going to read all of these off, but you can kind of see that the air-cooled system, where you draw in outside air and then exhaust the hot air to the outside again, it's pretty efficient. It is low cost, but maintenance tends to be very high on these systems. Installation cost tends to be high. Site visits are frequent, mainly because you're drawing in dirty air from the outside, putting it through your transmitter. And very filter dependent on how well that works and how much maintenance is required. But typically, when I've done these systems, you're looking at least monthly visits, if nothing else, but to clean the filters. The internally cooled system with the HVAC system in a closed loop, really high energy costs, but maintenance goes down quite a bit. Installation, not too bad. And fewer site visits. It's got great humidity control. There's a lot of advantages to this, and this is the way we've done it typically now for most of my time in the business. But what we're finding with liquid cooled is all of those issues are mitigated somewhat. Energy costs on this system are fairly low. Maintenance is very low. Installation costs, fairly low. It's pretty easy to do. Humidity control is great. Dust and dirt aren't a factor, and reliability of the system is very good. So we're kind of excited about liquid cooling. I think it's something that we're going to see a lot more of in the future for FM transmission. Okay, so out of that, we developed a new transmitter. It's the FLX liquid-cooled transmitter, and we designed it to be somewhere around 88% maximum overall heat dissipation into liquid efficiency. We can do this with internal or external pumps and put a 10 kilowatt transmitter, just the same as we do with FACS, a 10 kilowatt transmitter in a single rack, or 20 kilowatt transmitter in a single rack with dual power blocks. We can scale that system up just like we can in the air-cooled system to 20, 30, 40, up to 80 kilowatts we've done, and there's no reason to think we could not go higher. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the power and heat load of the system. And kind of now that we've been doing this for a little while, we've collected quite a bit of data. We've spent a lot of time really looking at this to see what the true efficiency advantages are to this. Particularly with these newer devices, in the liquid cooled, we're actually using the higher power, the higher peak power devices. and what we're finding is with these new devices, they're extremely good with higher peak powers in terms of efficiency, and maybe not as necessary for FM analog when we're not doing digital, when we don't need all that peak power. We can do the earlier versions of the, particularly we're talking about the Freescale device, where efficiency is actually a little bit higher, but the new devices provide higher peak power, and that's what we see in this graph. What we do is we adjust the PA voltage for the best efficiency, and then see how much power we can actually deliver by driving the power amplifiers into 2 dB of PA saturation. And what we find is with virtually any digital system, the advantage goes to these newer high peak power devices, lower voltage on the PAs and higher efficiency. Whoops. We can also optimize for best power. And again, these new devices are pretty incredible. Where at minus 14, we were able to get, and I can't really see it on a 10 kilowatt transmitter at minus 14 in the past, we were able to get about 10.5 kilowatts. We were able to get about 8.9 kilowatts out of the older devices. We're now able to get about 10.5 kilowatts at minus 14. So big jump in power capability with these devices, particularly in terms of digital peak power. When we want to look at best efficiency versus power and cooling, we took a lot of data. This is actually pretty hard to do, taking the intake air temperatures, outflow air temperatures, cabinet temperatures, and temperatures into and out of the liquid to extrapolate some data that we kind of had some theoretical numbers around. And what we found was pretty interesting in that at analog FM, where efficiencies are really high, where PA efficiencies tend to be at their highest, liquid cooling has certainly some advantages, but where the real advantages come in, again, is that higher peak power with lower efficiencies and higher dissipations. So we modeled this and came up with some graphs. Came up with some graphs around this efficiency. And on this chart, you can see the red line at the top. That's the total dissipation of the transmitter. We're looking basically at a 10 kilowatt transmitter here. Highest dissipation occurs around minus 14 dBc of HD injection and tends to roll off as we get higher because, of course, you've got to back the power of the transmitter off as you go to higher injections. At the same time, our TPO, our total transmitter power output, is diminishing as you increase that injection. So that's kind of why the dissipation fall off. But if you look at the total heat load into the room, you find that at minus 14, things actually get fairly high in terms of total heat load. At minus 10, they're at their maximum. And if we look at the liquid cool transfer, the higher the dissipation, of course, it makes sense. The higher the dissipation, the more transfer into liquid. And if you see the very faint gray line at the bottom, with liquid cooling, that's the heat that actually is transferred into the room. So pretty steady over the entire power and injection range. But as we increase injection, the efficiency of the liquid cooling heat to liquid thermal transfer improves dramatically as the injection levels go up and the total dissipation increases. So what we can take away from that is PA efficiency increases. The ratio of heat to liquid versus the heat to air efficiency increases. In other words, as the efficiency of the PAs increase, the transfer efficiency decreases. As the TPO decreases, the efficiency of the transmitter system decreases as well, and as well as the overall dissipation. But the heat to liquid transfer efficiency actually increases. As the PAs become less efficient, the heat to liquid transfer increases. FM mode at full power is the most efficient, so it exhibits the highest overall dissipation, but the worst case heat to liquid transfer efficiency. Minus 14 tends to be the worst case number, and that's what we typically use to calculate the air conditioning sizing and power sizing requirements for the system. We do have time. Okay, great. Let's talk a little bit about the architecture that we put into this first liquid-cooled transmitter. It's pretty interesting. What we tried to do is keep the architecture of our air-cooled transmitter as close as we possibly could. And quite frankly, we didn't know how well liquid cooling would be accepted by the market. There was a lot of initial resistance to this. So one of the criteria was, let's turn as few knobs as possible. Let's try to keep to the original, very successful FACS air-cooled transmitter and adapt that in the most efficient, best possible way into a liquid-cooled system. So here we see the power amplifier modules that are used in the air-cooled system with the 50-volt LD MOSFETs. And here is the modified version with the chiller plates attached directly to the LD MOSFET. We've just exchanged the air-cooled heat sink fins for a liquid chiller system. And if we take the cover off of that and look inside, there's some fairly clever engineering went into this to figure out how to maintain backflow pressure or prevent cavitation and get the best overall dispersion of the coolant across the device itself. And this is actually a bit of a thermal picture showing how the heat is dispersed across the cold plate. This is a typical air-cooled transmitter. It's what we started off with. This is a FACS 10-kilowatt power block. We've got seven of the General Electric high-efficiency power supplies, and seven, I know you see eight, one of them's the driver, the IPA, but we've got eight power amplifier modules. Air comes in the front, exhausts out the back. All we did simply in the liquid-cooled version is change out the, and there's a little more to it, changed out the air-cooled heat sink fin type heat sinks and changed those to this liquid-cooled chiller plate. This pretty much was the major change we did in the system to make it liquid-cooled. We added a couple of other things. There's a chiller plate on the 14-way splitter. That's where the ISO loads live for the 14-way combiner. So we cool that, and we also let it do double duty. It's also the manifold for distribution to the power amplifier modules. And on the right there, you see the liquid cooling distribution system with the hoses connected. So essentially, it's going to be tough. Okay, input, we have liquid input there at the bottom of the transmitter. And by the way, the liquid that we use, nothing more than Prestone antifreeze. We used to use some fancy mixes of 50-50 glycol, and now we just recommend Prestone antifreeze. You can get it any AutoZone. It works really, really well. Anyway, we have input. That flows through the distribution system and to each of the across the ISO loads of the combiner, into the power amplifier modules, back out of the power amplifier modules and into that chiller plate, and for the reject loads, and then finally, if we can get it to switch, we do have the output and then the variable speed flushing fans. Now we've gone from 4 fans on the air-cooled system to 2 fans on the liquid-cooled system. And here you can actually see in the back of it, the picture on the left is with the door open and the hoses and the manifold distribution in the back of the transmitter. And on the right-hand side is the actual installation with the 2 fans and the liquid input and liquid output. That little unit there on the at the front on the hose to the manifold, that's actually our flow meter, and that's where we measure flow through the system. Each power block has its own flow meter. System block diagram, pretty simple and about what you would expect. You've got the pump system that provides the flow through the system. There are 2 speed-controlled pumps. The speed is controlled by the temperature of the coolant. As there's higher heat demand, those pumps will speed up. They're dual pumps, only one runs at a time. They're in dual backup, so if one fails or you want to manually switch them, or you can set them up on a timer to switch between the 2 pumps and to maintain the usage, keep the usage even on them. That pumps out to the external heat exchanger. That's a 2-fan system. Again, the fans are speed controlled and redundant. So as only one fan may be running at a time, if it needs to, it'll bring 2 up, and it ramps that speed up. They're DC controlled, frequency controlled through an inverter. So those fans will speed up and slow down as heat demands changes over the course of the day with environmental temperature. A little bit about HVAC versus liquid consumption. This is just a graph to show that, something didn't quite come out right there. I'm not sure why. Basically, we're talking about 158,000 total, 158.8 kilowatts total consumption with an air-cooled system versus about 136.3 total consumption kilowatts in a liquid-cooled system. In an air-cooled system, and the graphic got messed up there, but it's about 16% of the energy consumed used in an HVAC closed-loop cooled system is about 16% of the energy consumption is actually in the HVAC system. It's actually just to cool, 16% is used to cool the transmitter. In a liquid-cooled system, about 4%, 2% to the liquid system, 2% to the air system is what's used to cool the transmitter in a liquid-cooled system. All the rest of that actually goes to the power consumption of the transmitter. The high-efficiency pump module, I mentioned that. This is our third-generation pump module. We've been doing this in television for quite a while. We're using new mag drive type pumps, very high efficiency, auto-cycling, really quiet, low noise, they're impeller driven. You can actually replace a pump while the system's on the air. It's a pressurized system. There's an expansion tank there to maintain a constant about 12 PSI throughout the system, and no matter what the coolant level is. So you've basically got 12 pounds of pressure there that's maintained. No matter how much coolant is actually flowing in the system. It's constantly adjusting for temperature to maintain the appropriate flow rate to maintain transmitter temperature. The external heat exchangers look like this. They can be mounted either horizontally or vertically. They would typically sit out on a pad outside of the transmitter building. They're dual fans, high efficiency. Again, I mentioned they're inverter controlled, so the fans will speed up and slow down, even almost stop sometimes if the demand isn't high. We have either a 20 kilowatt version or a 50 kilowatt version. 20 kilowatt version can basically run a 20 kilowatt transmitter with headroom, and the 50 kilowatt on up to our 40 kilowatt transmitters. And here's a look at the actual installation. This is a 10 kilowatt installation, pretty simple. You've got supply and return manifold coming into the top of the rack. It just feeds down to the supply and return in and out of the power block. This is a typical rack installation, one of our power blocks. Everything here is the same size as the air-cooled system. And then on the 20 kilowatt transmitter, just like we do in the air-cooled system, there are two power blocks mounted on top of each other, a 3EB combiner between them, and a manifold set. The incoming liquid comes in on one hose and is distributed to each of the two power blocks through a distribution manifold. And there on the very right, you actually see that installation in the back of a 20 kilowatt transmitter. Excuse me. And then in a 40, we do the same thing. It's 220 kilowatts, just as we do in the air cool. It's 220 kilowatt transmitters side by side. There's 3dB combiners between the two 10 kilowatt power blocks and a 3dB combiner between the two 20 kilowatt racks. And then we have two paths of liquid distribution, one to each rack. By the way, all of these are independent of one another. There's valves on each of the power blocks, so you can isolate that power block from the system if you need to take it out of line and do maintenance on that particular transmitter. Each transmitter has a drain, so the system can be drained at the power block level. So everything can be isolated from the main system. All of these things, you can do the maintenance on the pumps, you can do maintenance on the pump motors, you can do maintenance on the heat exchanger motors, all while the system is running. So maximum uptime on these systems. And then as these supply and return hoses may go up to the ceiling, they go into something called an H valve that does the distribution out to each of the racks. So racks can be isolated themselves from this H-valve assembly, and that's how that's basically all distributed. Then it goes on to the pump module and out to the heat exchanger. And here's a look at a 20-kilowatt transmitter, actually put together. This is the one in the lab in Mason, but we've actually, before we even had before we had a 40-kilowatt transmitter in Mason for testing, we actually shipped 240 kilowatts. So we've got 240 kilowatts on the air now. We've got a couple of 30s out there as well. We've got a couple of 20s. And of course, our first 10-kilowatt went on the air at WSUN. That's Cox Media down in Hollywood, Florida. Down in southern Florida, and they're doing well. They're doing really, really well. Temperature in Florida last year, we put it in around Christmas time, and over the summer, temperature got up to about 100 degrees out there, and we were a little concerned about it, how it was actually going to do, you know, when environmental temperatures got up over 100, and the temperature rise on the coolant was only about 10 degrees. The concept of liquid cooling does work very well. It's got the efficiency, and it can maintain operating temperatures quite well, even in the harshest environments, it looks like. We're looking forward. We've got one going in Texas here very shortly. We'll be interested to see. It's a 40 kilowatt. We'll be interested to see what the kind of temperature differentials and performance we get in the really hot, dry climate of Texas. So I think that's about it. I'm open to questions. Yeah, in the back there. Okay, hang on for microphones.
Thanks. Could you describe the process of swapping out PAs? And also, could you also describe the flexible hosing? What are the materials and the lifespan?
Yeah, and thank you for bringing that up, because I actually forgot. One of the proudest things we have in this is in the liquid-cooled system is the hot pluggability of these modules. They have, and if you remember, and I could probably go back, but it's not worth it. The modules themselves have two valves on them. They're quick disconnect valves, liquid valves, and they're a plunger type valve. There's a male and a female, and when it's inserted, it actually presses the plunger on the two sides. So both sides are sealed as soon as it's removed. Both sides are sealed, and the module can be removed, and new module can be inserted. You know, we love that. Again, back to the technology where it used to be, you know, you needed to be able to work with high voltage and tubes, and the training of our technical folks had to be, you know, very high for their own safety. Now, you know, you come in and it's red light, green light. If the red light is on, pull the module out, go to the shelf, put the other module in, green light, everything's great, go home, don't touch anything else. And with this, both our air-cooled and liquid-cooled, you can do that with the power modules. They're all hot pluggable, hot swappable, and quick sealing. And we've had really good success with these valves. Absolutely no drips, no leaks. We've had no malfunctions with these. Other than, one of the things you have to watch out for in these systems is contamination in the system. We have a screen filter in the liquid cooling loop that will catch any debris and things that actually get in the system. But since it's closed loop, that doesn't, you know, that's really not an issue. There's not much that can get in there. But we do recommend, you know, checking that screen like once a year and cleaning it of any debris. And certainly when we bring the system up for the first time, you want to run that system with the transmitter out of the loop for several hours and flush through the hoses to get any debris out of those. Now, you brought up the hoses. It can be done a couple of ways. The easiest way, and the way we supply the standard kit, is with 100 feet of, it's an ASTM, I don't remember the number, but it's a red rubber hose. It's 1.25 inches. It's pretty easy to work with. And then everything else is just standard plumbing fittings. We use compression fittings and hose clamps, but the hose is that red liquid hose. It's with the, what it's a fabric inner, it's rubber inner, fabric, and then rubber outer. It's pretty tough stuff, but really easy to work with. Typical installation time for a liquid cool transmitter system, unless you make things really complicated, it can be done basically in an afternoon.
Yeah. What provisions are there included in the transmitter for the monitoring of the health of the system? Mm-hmm. Things like temperatures, temperature rises, flow, any monitoring of possible pump failures, etc.
Right. Great question. So we monitor the flow at each power block. So that's the flow wheel at the back. The flow is monitored. The temperature in the power block is monitored in several places. We have several trip points for flow and temperature. Mainly, that's what we're looking at, is flow and temperature. Now, in the event of pump failure, you will actually get it'll switch to the alternate pump. If it loses flow in one system, it'll switch to the other pump unit. And that's all flagged in the system. That all goes back to the remote control system. We monitor that. We don't actually monitor the fan speeds. That tended to be a little unnecessary and a little more difficult than was practical. But we do monitor that coolant temperature, and if we see a temperature rise, you'll see the fan speed up, you'll see the pump speed up. All of that, that information, that flow is increasing, temperature is increasing, that's all back to the remote control system. We have several trip points to issue warnings, and finally to issue a fault to shut down. We had an interesting thing. We were showing transmitters to a customer in Mason, and they said, well, what happens if you lose a phase on the pump module? And we hadn't quite worked a couple things out yet, and so we just went over and pulled a phase. And lo and behold, the heat exchanger in this particular case kept running, but the pumps shut down. And the transmitter kept running. And we're going, okay, all right, we've caused this. Now let's see what really happens. Now, of course, this is with the customer standing there. And they got a little excited, but it did exactly what it was supposed to. We watched on a remote control. We watched the temperature rise. Temperature on the transmitter continued to go up. All of a sudden, we get a yellow warning on the system that temperature had exceeded, I forgot the warning threshold, but it exceeded the warning threshold. Now the engineer who's about to get this transmitter is just having a fit. He's like, shut my transmitter off. I'm like, no, hold on. Let's see what it really does. It went up two more degrees, and then the transmitter shut down. So that was pretty great, and it protected it, and it did exactly what it's supposed to. Now, we had to work out that phase thing, because ideally, you could lose a phase on this system because of the way the power supplies are arranged. You should be able to lose a phase, and the transmitter should keep running, and the pump should keep running, and so we've worked all that out. But that was pretty exciting. Yes?
Are you familiar with a medicine company that's using a similar system for cooling microprocessors in server farms? The only difference is they use a non-conductive, non-corrosive liquid, and at the heat sink interface, it's more of an evaporative cooling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, I don't remember the company offhand, but they came and talked to me, I think it was NAB 2 years ago, with that similar discussion. And, as far as coolants and the systems, what I remember when we looked at that was, this is great, this is really efficient, but the practicality of it for a transmitter system was a little too esoteric. This is great stuff and something we ought to look at, but at least for now, to keep things simple, we're talking about keeping things as simple as we can, and again, being able to go to AutoZone and pick up some Prestone. But it's something we this may evolve into in the future. Yes.
So 12 PSI, that's a pretty reasonable number for being able to handle it, the fittings. What kind of GPM do you have to run through this?
And yeah, great question. Typically, we try to keep it around 8 gallons per minute. That's the optimum flow.
That's extremely low, too. That's all very reasonable.
Yeah, it's all low-pressure stuff, all low-flow stuff.
And as far as coolant, is that Dow Therm, Eukatherm?
No, I say Prestone.
Oh, just off the shelf,
antifreeze. Off the shelf, Prestone. It works great. Our mechanical guys went through it with a fine-tooth comb, and it works very well with the system.
Even with the additives that are in antifreeze, it doesn't eat up the fittings?
Nope. No, it's quite good on it.
And what do you think the life of the fluid is? How often do you have to change out?
We're recommending, we've got experience with this in television. The Prestone's kind of new because we were using the Dow Therm in television previously, and we recommended a five-year change out. Yes.
Actually, never mind. He asked both my questions, so I'm good.
Great. Great. Anybody else?
hybrids?
Yeah.
Miners, they're still air-cooled, right?
Yeah, they are. And, you know, thanks for bringing these things up. There are things in the transmitter that do generate heat. Obviously, the power supplies, the 14-way combiner, and the 3dB hybrids that we don't liquid cool. And what we found, you know, when we really did our analysis is in the overall scheme of things, they didn't contribute enough to the heat load to justify the expense and the R&D and the mechanical to actually cool those. They contribute, their contribution was very, very low. So no, we don't cool those, and we don't cool the power supplies, and that actually works well.
Thank you. What about, I have a building with cooling tower water. You obviously wouldn't want to run that through the system, but what about a heat exchanger to cool
great
the
question
water?
Too. Hadn't really looked at and discussed the cooling tower heat exchanger type of concept, but we've talked a lot about liquid-to-liquid and air-to-liquid heat exchangers in different applications. Geothermal is one that we're really, really interested in, and we've got a customer, again, out in Texas, who's very interested in doing a geothermal heat exchanger system. So we'll keep you posted on that. Yep.
Green or pink Prestone?
It is the pink Prestone. I mean, that's what I've seen guys use. I don't know what you probably could use the green. Anybody else? Well, I want to thank you all very much. Thanks for having me. I hope I kept you entertained and awake this morning. We'll see you around.